The following podcast is an Embassy Row production.
Hey, everybody. I'm Mark Lamont Hill, owner of Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books. I am a professor, a scholar, and most importantly, a book nerd. I say book nerd because I don't just love to read books. I'm the person who loves to read about the book. I love hearing authors talk about how and why they wrote the book, and I love talking to other book nerds about their favorite books. That's why I started Coffee and Books. It's a podcast all about books. Every episode, I sit down over a cup of coffee with the world's biggest authors to discuss the most interesting, controversial, fun, and important books. Sometimes I hang out with experts, fans, and other special guests to talk about some of the greatest books of all time. And today is by far one of the most important episodes of Coffee and Books that we will ever have. Today, you will hear my conversation with Mumia Abu-Jamal. For those that don't know, Mumia Abu-Jamal is a political prisoner who has been incarcerated since 1981. While he was convicted for the murder of Officer Daniel Faulkner, many people, hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions of people around the world, including myself, maintain that he is both legally not guilty and factually innocent. And for the last 40 years, we have fought to, one, get Mumia Abu-Jamal off of death row, which we were successful at, and now to get him home. Despite the fact that Mumia Abu-Jamal has been incarcerated for all this time, he never stopped being what he was before he went in. Long before he was incarcerated, Mumia was a journalist. He was a writer. He was an activist. He was a thinker. He was a radio host. He did so many things. And after being incarcerated, Mumia didn't stop. Mumia has written numerous books, including the bestseller Live from Death Row, All Things Censored, Death Blossoms, Faith of Our Fathers, We Want Freedom, Jailhouse Lawyers, and of course, a book that I wrote with Mumia Abu-Jamal called The Classroom in the Cell, Conversations on Black Life in America. For years, I've been communicating with Mumia Abu-Jamal through phone. We wrote our book through phone conversations and letters. And right now, he is in Frackville, PA, incarcerated in SCI Mahanoy, a Pennsylvania state prison. Getting this interview was incredibly challenging. Mumia is only allowed to talk on the phone for 10 to 15 minutes. The phone calls are constantly interrupted by operator voices and security alerts. And so to get this interview done, it took literally months of phone calls, of appointment setting, of cutoff conversations, of trying to remember where we picked up, of trying to keep a rhythm. But because Mumia is such a genius and he's such a pro and he cares so much about books, we were able to, after literally dozens of conversations, put together an interview, a conversation that I think speaks to his genius, speaks to his love of books, and has lessons for all of us as we're trying to figure out how to get free.
This is a call from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
To accept this free call, press 1. To refuse this free, thank you for using Securus. You may start the conversation now.
What's up, man?
Hey, buddy.
First of all, Mumia, it's good to have you on the show, brother. This is an honor and a privilege.
Well, the privilege is mine, brother. I mean, we do, pretty good work together.
That's right. Mumia has written many books, but his seventh book was one that I was blessed to write with him. It's called The Classroom and the Cell, Conversations on Black Life in America. And that book has had a profound impact on me. It was a beautiful journey writing with you. And now you've written how many books now?
If I say I lost count, that'll sound real arrogant, but I think about 12.
Man. When you were first, and we'll talk about our process too, but when you were first incarcerated, did you imagine that you'd be writing books? Did you have any idea that you would have spent the time that you spent writing as an author?
No, and I'll tell you why. I mean, I grew up like most people of my generation, as a Malcolmite. And, you know, having been read and deeply influenced by the autobiography of Malcolm X, he famously said, and I think he was quoting his mentor,
this is a call from
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
His mentor, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, that, you know, if you want to hide something from a Negro, put it in a book.
Right.
So that was my thinking. And when people around me were like, oh, you need to make this a book, I kind of poo-pooed the idea. I resisted it. And when they kept saying it, I kind of half-heartedly said, okay, well, you know, what do I need to do? Okay, here it is. And I never thought that it would become what it has become and become the living thing that it has become. And
that book is Live from Death Row, for those that don't know. That was your first book. And it's an interesting book. It's memoir, but it's not like I'm going to tell a story about sort of everything that's happened to me. It's also an analysis of what's happening in the prisons.
Absolutely. And begins, and I think its first two chapters are about the prison, then the Black Freedom Movement, then growing up as part of the Black Panther Party, and a memoir in the back about meditating about death. And who knew? I mean, it really had a life of its own. Life from Death Row was very alive, let me put it that way.
Yeah, and it was a powerful book. It was a bestseller. But it also sparked a lot of controversy. People in the prison were upset. They said, well, you know, you shouldn't be making money off of a book if you're incarcerated.
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution.
You're absolutely correct.
And the idea that could be a book for me is no surprise. But what it became, and I think you're right, it wasn't the most successful book, but it showed your depth and your range. Death Blossoms was the kind of book that showed that you were deeply, you know, engaged in a tradition of reading, not just writing as a journalist, but reading scholars, reading writers, reading, you know, a range of traditions. And I think that in many ways is a testimony to your intellect. You know, in this show, you know, a lot of times we talk about their books. You got so many books, we can't talk about all of them, but there are a few that just were so special to me that I wanted to think about. All Things Censored, for me, was an interesting book. It plays on the NPR show, All Things Considered. Could you give just a little bit of context of why you wrote that book?
Because I had been hired by All Things Considered to be a correspondent. And the state and its minions objected so vociferously that the invitation was withdrawn at the ninth hour, so to speak.
Mm.
And, you know, that was the contradiction. And, you know, we fought. There was a lawsuit. It was unsuccessful. But, you know, it opened up the door, really, for all of my writing. Because at the time that actually happened, Live from Death Row was being born.
Right.
And, you know, All Things Censored is a later book about that period, though. And, you know, we filed the suit. It went all the way up to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And the Third Circuit said, well, you know, the guy is protected by the First Amendment. He can write whatever he wants to write. And it'd be better that he write now before he gets executed.
I'm not laughing, but it's funny because that's literally how they think about this stuff.
Absolutely. That's what they said in the actual opinion. So I, you know, agreed with their opinion and proceeded to write my ass off.
That you did. And you haven't stopped.
No, I know. And I don't think I ever will. I mean, books are places where wisdom can still be found in a society that really celebrates spectacle.
One of the things that I really wanted to talk to you about was another one of your projects that I think was so important, and that's Jailhouse Lawyers. Why did you write that book?
I was asked to do it after I was talking about prison suits and cases that prisoners had done with Selma James, the widow of CLR.
Yes.
We got very close many years ago when I was on the row, and I was talking to her, and she said, well, what's a jailhouse lawyer? I explained it to her. She said, that's utterly fascinating. You should write a book about it. And so I did. I mean, because I had never really met someone who didn't know what a jailhouse lawyer was, and it kind of focused my attention to really, you know, read the cases, to go back to the foundations and the fundament, read Supreme Court cases, read statutes, read transcripts of people's trials. It actually fascinated me more than I had initially, you know, regarded. And I'd always remembered something that the late good brother Delbert Africa told me about jailhouse lawyers and how they believed in the law so much that when they went into court and they got shot down and thrown up against the wall, it drove them insane because their belief was shattered. So I wrote about that in the introduction and then went straight to, you know, fascinating cases of people fighting in the system who could not afford a lawyer, and that's, you know, really many, many people.
Absolutely. And
for civil law.
I also love how the book talks about the kind of history of how both Republicans and Democrats worked to close the courthouse door to prisoners, especially the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which is signed under Bill Clinton, and also breaking down sort of how and why all of that happened. I mean, you are an interesting sort of person because you're doing all this research, you're doing all this scholarship. Again, the first couple of books, you know, you're talking about death row, you're talking about the conditions of your case, you're talking about the conditions of the prison. But you've grown out and decided to do a whole range of other things, whether it's the short essays you do for prison radio that are vocal, but that you also write, or other stuff. How do you decide what you're going to write about?
It's really like what rings a bell, what is of interest, and what I think people have never heard before. I mean, I hate doing the common story. You know, journalists are like a herd. My old boss at the radio that I interned at before I went on the air used to tell me that journalists are like dogs fighting over a fire hydrant, you know, the court to get the...
Right.
I was like, I don't get that. I couldn't really understand it. Well, he was giving me the truth from his many years as an editor and a journalist of a radio station. And it bores me to do the same story.
Yeah.
You go where no one is telling the story. And you tell the stories that no one else is telling. And you end up telling some pretty good stories because there are millions of stories. As remember the saying, there are millions of stories in the naked city?
Yeah.
There are millions of stories in prison and no one tells these stories. So I began telling them. And I think people have reacted with shock and amazement. But I find them stories that need to be told.
One of my favorite things I've ever done in life was to write The Classroom in the Cell with you. And for those that don't know, The Classroom in the Cell is a book that Mumia and I wrote about 8 years ago. Time moves so fast. And it was a set of conversations between Mumia and I. He was still on death row at SCI Green in Pennsylvania. And I was a professor at the time at Teachers College, Columbia University. And the book began with a set of conversations between Mumia and me on the phone. We would talk Friday around 5 o'clock, and then we would talk about different topics, actually 9 topics based on the Move 9, which we'll talk about later. And then we would have letter writing practices through the mail. And also I'd go to the prison and visit, and we'd talk some more. And that book turned out to be really a special book for me. What was it like for you to do that book in terms of, especially in terms of like the conversations we were having?
Well, Mark, it was a walk into the unknown because I had never done a book with someone else before. And as you know, I mean, you've written so many yourself, you know that writing is an intimate process. It was especially intimate for me because all of the ones I had written before and since, for the most part, have been written in a jail cell or on death row or on phase 2 with a death warrant. So to like really share that intimate space of the mind with another person was a new experience and exhilarating. You know, it wasn't easy, I don't think.
No.
I don't think it was. No, it wasn't intended to be, right? But I think it was deeply honest. I think it was like us expressing our inner selves to each other as men and talking about the world around us. And talking about the need for love and compassion, you know, especially in movements, but really in our lives. You know, men talk about sports, or they lie about girls and women. Am I right? Right?
100%.
We don't talk about what's in our hearts because we fear that kind of intimacy. And that's real intimacy because it's, you know, you have these conversations with yourself, but you don't share it with your brethren. And I think this was a sharing. This really was a conversation.
Yeah.
And I think it was a lovely, and I think it remains a lovely, deep, touching piece of work that a lot of people share with us.
No, absolutely, man. You know, whenever I visit prisons and talk to brothers, that's the book that people say that resonated with them the most. When I'm on the street, like, you know, there are books that I've written that people, you know, academics like, that you know, sort of, but the people who come in my bookstore like, but when I'm in the hood, when I'm in the streets, it's The Classroom in the Cell that people talk about. And what they bring up is that thing you just said, which is, this idea that we share, and it was vulnerability. And, you know, that book came, for those that don't know, that book came out of real organic conversations. Mumia and I were talking in 2008 before Obama won the presidency. And Mumia called me for the first time out of nowhere. I didn't know him. We hadn't met. You know, I'd worked on his campaign and his case for years, but I got this phone call out the blue and we started talking. And it was beautiful. And the first thing we said was, yo, you think he gonna win? And we knew he was Obama. And we would talk about the election and we would build on, you know, what we thought was gonna happen for the election, et cetera. And then the conversations kept growing and the book came out of those natural conversations about being Black men, about being from North Philly, about love, about fatherhood, about all this stuff. And so I think that's why I love the book. But with me, I'm gonna tell you something. The toughest part of that book, The Classroom in the Cell, was the love chapter. Because, you know, we had written about culture. We talked about mass incarceration. We talked about the elections. We talked about the revolution. But I said, yo, we're going to talk about love this week, next week, or whatever week day it was. And when the conversation turned to love, you sounded nervous. I felt nervous. I'm like, this Negro is on death row. And I ain't never heard you sound scared on death row, but when we said we're going to talk about love, you sounded shook. I was shook. And it took an extra couple of weeks to get that chapter right because of how hard we worked on it. But it was beautiful, no?
Yes, sir. It was. And it was a labor of love. But I think that, you know, that's what love does. It really transforms and transcends everything. You know, the Bible talks about if you have everything in the world, but you don't have love, you have nothing.
Mm. Talk to me a little bit about your journey as a writer. When did you first realize that you were a writer?
Strangely enough, when I was a member of the Black Panther Party, and I was put on the newspaper staff. You know, the party actually sent me from Philadelphia to New York and out to California to work on the paper. And, you know, I had done, like, leaflets in Philly and a booklet or two. But to work on that paper was, like, in many ways, a dream come true. But it was like, that was, unlike any of my contemporaries in that field, you know, my journalism school was the editorial offices of the Black Panther Party.
Mm.
So you wrote a certain way to be accessible, you know, to average folks, but also to not have a care about, like, corporate influence. You know, for a decade, largely, the party never took advertising. You know, and then towards its last period, it did. But, you know, the cost of the paper, 25 cents, really was sufficient to, you know, reproduce the paper, buy necessary requirements to rent offices and rent living space around the country. Because a nickel went a whole lot further than it does now.
That's for sure.
You know, and to last for over a decade is really something, I think, quite remarkable.
No, absolutely. So, and you got that writerly identity there. How did you develop your craft? Because you have a very particular style. You know, I learned that reading you. Were you mentored as a writer when you first started writing a newspaper and even as you were writing books?
Well, they placed me in the Ministry of Information. And that was the ministry I was in when I was in Philly. And so I stayed in that ministry throughout my whole tenure. And a few years ago, well, more than a few years ago, I reread Eldridge Cleaver's Soul on Ice, and it blew my mind. You know, and I knew it almost by heart, but what I learned reading him was that his influence on my writing style was profound, more than I had known, frankly. But to read him, I saw the skeletal forces that underlay many of my writing forms, because, you know, I'm reading him as a teenager.
Yeah.
And therefore that influence, right, it truly was profound. And, you know, he was the Minister of Information and he influenced the party, Huey would say, negatively, but, you know, negatively or positively, he had a profound influence on the whole organization. But his writing, Soul on Ice, his articles in the paper, they shaped all of them.
What was it about his style that you took on? What were some of the things that, like, you feel like are the skeletal parts of what you do?
In many ways, it was unpredictable. In a lot of ways, like, what I saw in Eldridge was that he wrote with a kind of fury. right?
Yeah.
And I am certain, looking back over, that it came from his prison years. And, you know, when you're doing time, you lose time.
Yeah.
Because that's dead time. But once you come out into the world, you're trying to make an impact on the world that made an impact on you negatively. So he wrote with a fierceness and a fury that a lot of brothers and sisters did not do if they had not experienced the prison nation. And I'm sure that colored and flavored my writing as well.
There are people who use the term prison intellectual. Dylan Rodriguez, a radical scholar who comes out of a critical resistance tradition, actually one of Angela Davis's students, talks about, you know, these kind of insurgent, radical prison intellectuals. Do you see yourself as an intellectual? And does the prison do anything for you? Or rather, how does the prison kind of shape who you are as a thinker, as a writer? What role does it all play?
Well, I think in prison, you see the state and the world, the universe, in fact, nakedly, without its lace curtain, without the dance. You see it openly, savagely, truly. You see the soul of the state that underlays the prison structure. And you also, because of your physical, societal, and social, and I speak of those as two different things, isolation, you're able to concentrate in ways that are unavailable to someone in the outer world, as opposed to the imprisoned world. I mean, if you read George Jackson.
Yes.
Truly, he was probably the best known of prison intellectuals. He went as far as he could. And you can read him today, and, you know, without some dated references, you can see the skeleton of the American empire.
Oh, absolutely. And for those out there listening, Blood in My Eye and Soledad Brother, being the
That's
two
right.
texts, you know, Soledad Brother being more of an epistolary novel, you know, he's writing letters. Blood in My Eye is straight, you know, radical critical theory. And George Jackson, somebody who got radicalized in prison, right? So he's someone who comes to prison for a minor offense and then develops his radical consciousness there. You're somebody who comes into the prison with a radical consciousness. So it's two very different pathways, but they both lead to this really interesting prison intellectual that we have to think about.
Absolutely. Eldridge Cleaver's Soul on Ice. It wasn't until I read it years later that I could see, right, in my own work, the very deep influence he had and how I used language, how I, you know, approached description and stuff like that. His work was something to learn from because, you know, nobody else wrote quite as expressively as did he. I mean, he was an extraordinary writer. And he was really the first member of the party who was seen as an author and a journalist and so forth, and the Minister of Information. So he made a hell of an impact on me.
Yeah, no. Who else did you read? You know, you are a reader for sure. And when did you first start, like, reading? And what were the first books that kind of got you where you wanted to be as a reader?
Franz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth. It was difficult.
How old were you when you were reading Fanon?
I was about 15.
Woo!
Yeah. I later learned that one of my sons read it when he was about 15. And unlike me, he had a better shot at really interpreting it because he had a better education than his old man. But, of course, Eldridge, in time, he was probably the best known, but, you know, Huey was very prolific. Bobby even put out several books. Seize the Time, I think, was his first. And, you know, we would read those as part of our work as Panthers to kind of internalize the history of the early years of the party, you know, and to learn from the struggles they had to help us in the struggles we were having. So one thing that is certain and was not common among the Black Freedom Movement, especially the Black Revolutionary
Freedom. This is a call from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
We read. And a lot of times we would read and then try to discuss things at our PE or political education meetings. And so we had to read and really understand in order to talk about the stuff we read. So we were encouraged to read, to use our spare time to read, and then to talk to each other to kind of share the insights that we had.
Mm. Wow.
I remember reading Marx, and bruh, I couldn't make head nor tails. I remember reading, trying to read Capital. Oh, boy.
Oof.
I couldn't get nothing with it, man. Not...
Man, it's scholars who spend their whole career trying to make sense of Das Kapital by Karl Marx. So the fact that you were doing it in your teens and 20s, it says something. But, you know, there's also something interesting, I think, about what it means to be in political education and community education places, not in the university. I mean, so much of your growth as a reader and as a writer, as a thinker, as a scholar, came not from a formal institution, although you have degrees, but from the community education, from bookstores, from collectives. I mean, talk about that. Oh, yeah. that role.
Well, there was a bookstore, and I'm told it no longer exists, but it was called Robbins.
Oh, yes,
at
Robbins.
Height, they had two sites.
That's right. And for those outside of Philly, Robbins was an independent sort of left-wing bookstore in downtown Philadelphia that was a staple in the city really until the kind of big box retailers and Amazon and everybody else came along and kind of pushed them out of the space.
This is a call from
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
They really had a rich load of black books from around the world, around the country. And, you know, I would go in and because I didn't have the money to buy the book, I would stand there and read. And I remember the old guy that owned it, Larry Wright. He said, "Hey, kid, this isn't a library. This is a bookstore." I said, "Shut up." And I continued reading. But, I mean, it was like a kid in a candy store.
Yeah.
Because, you know, all of the really, really great black historians of the middle of the 20th century, J.A. Rogers, all his stuff was there. Frantz Fanon, all his stuff was there. Kwame Nkrumah, all his stuff was there. And so you could literally go from one great book to another great book. I hated leaving it, you know. I hated leaving it. I loved just going in there and seeing all that stuff and, you know, smelling the books. You know, it wasn't the kind of stuff you could read in a library, because I don't believe the library, even one as great and renowned and as long working as the Philadelphia Free Library, had a lot of those work.
Yeah, you definitely couldn't get them in school, right?
Oh, hell no. But it was a wonderful institution. It really was. And they were, long before the local Philadelphia branch had an office, we would order the newspapers from San Francisco and Oakland through the bookstore.
Mm.
And it was safer to get it through the bookstore than for, you know, the party just to send us to it directly. Because, you know, there were many times we got the papers and they would be drenched with an odious chemical, or some pigs would urinate on it, you name it. Well, we never got it at all. So thank goodness for an independent bookstore.
No, I'm glad you said that, because I think there's a lot of people who don't understand the political role that bookstores played, you know, feminist bookstores in the 50s, 60s, and particularly 60s and 70s, rather. Independent left-wing bookstores all around the country, and of course, black bookstores have played not just a role in terms of getting us access to books we otherwise wouldn't read, which is, of course, the case, but they also served a very concrete political function. We would organize there. We would have meetings there.
Absolutely.
You know, and in what you're just describing is also a kind of subversive space, like a subversive kind of counter-public thing where the bookstore itself helps protect you from the violence of the state.
Absolutely.
Wow. Talk to me a little bit. What else were you reading? I know you said you read Fanon, you read Cleaver, you read J.A. Rogers. I mean, it seemed to me you were on a kind of a journey toward embracing both left-wing politics, but also an African-centered tradition, understanding who black people were beyond and before slavery. How intentional were those two directions, and were there other things you were thinking about?
Well, again, I go to Frantz Fanon, the Martinique-born psychiatrist who, after finishing medical school in France, went to Algeria and became a supporter and a revolutionary in support of the Algerian revolution. Now, that's North Africa. It's really an Arab society.
So The Wretched of the Earth for you was an important book. Why was that such an important text for you?
Well, you know, it was required for officers and members of the Black Panther Party. Now, I'm 15, perhaps, and it was translated from the French. So that in itself is a challenge. But it was also, you know, it took me years to understand not just what Frantz Fanon wrote, but how he wrote. And almost everything that he ever wrote, he wrote from his perspective, not just as a doctor, but as a psychiatrist, right?
Mm.
And, you know, he analyzed colonialism as a disease. And he had the depth and perception to really psychoanalyze oppression. And that is what The Wretched of the Earth is about. I mean, there are passages in there where he talks about treating members of the colonialist army fighting against the Algerians. And a guy says, you know, I keep hearing screams. He said, why are you hearing screams? He says, because I spend my nights torturing people, and then when I go to sleep, all I hear is screams. He said, well, stop torturing me. I mean,
this
you know,
is a call
this
from
enough,
Pennsylvania
you know?
State Correctional
and,
Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is
really
subject to recording and monitoring.
To the black movement all around the world, because you know, he could see things so clearly, and he put that into his work. And you know, it took. I know Kathleen; she always writes about Frantz Fanon. And he,
Kathleen Cleaver, yeah,
right, the former member of Central Committee. Eldridge Cleaver's former wife, just brilliant thinker, a brilliant writer, but she really got so much out of Frantz Fanon that it forced you to go back and think through and read through the things that he wrote about in that book. That was pivotal for a lot of people, but it was really very important for me just to learn as a young Panther, but also to think about it many, many years later. Because there are 1,000 lessons there, because he put it all in his books.
Mm.
And that's not just Wretched of the Earth. Towards the African Revolution, a dying colonialism, all these kinds of things he put real serious work into.
Yeah.
And I think people are still like reading and gleaning the insights that Dr. Frantz Fanon put into his work. And it is a gift. And I think not just for black revolutionaries, but for anyone who is looking at the system from the perspective of the oppressed and trying to find a way through freedom, liberation.
Hmm.
So he's, you know, he was key. He really was key.
I think about the writers who have written from captivity, the people who have written from prison, you, George Jackson, we could go on. You know, what does it mean to be a prison writer? Or a prison thinker? I feel like it's more than just somebody who's writing from prison. It feels like there's something else about the space, about the texts that get produced, about who you become or how you get there that make it different. What does it mean to you to be a prison writer?
Well, I think it gives you a kind of freedom that those in other institutions don't have, because you don't have the film that other institutions possess. You're looking at really the heart, the guts, the innards of the state. And, you know, the state in its prisons is naked in its cruelty, open in its contempt, racist in its communication, and as class-bound as only the state can be. So you see truths. You don't see illusions. So it frees you to speak truth to that power. And like, think about this. If you read George Jackson, you're stunned by his insights, his revelations. But, you know, George, I think he was serving 7 to eternity.
Right. For a petty crime. We're talking about, and for those that don't know, we're talking about George. Yeah.
The indeterminate sentence, which meant forever.
Yeah.
But he was the freest, you know, think about reading that when you're 15, 16.
Mm.
You know?
Soledad, brother.
Yes. And Eldridge was, too, because he was free to think forbidden thoughts. You know, if you read Eldridge, like, Soul on Ice. I mean, it's a trip. It takes you places that most writers won't even think about. So you stretch to be that which you are not but want to be, which is free.
Mm.
In your writing, in your thinking, in your expression. And you know, prison is the perfect palette for someone who wants to write like an artist.
Ooh, that's interesting. I think about what Tupac said. They interviewed Tupac one time, and he was like, yo, everybody think I'm in here just writing songs like crazy because, you know, I got all this time and energy. He said, prison killed my creativity. I couldn't produce while I was in here. Are there any ways that the prison actually makes it harder or undermines your creativity or your ability to think through this stuff because of how depressing and oppressive it is?
Well, they can have that effect or they can sharpen. And it can free you or it can oppress you. But that's your choice, how you respond to that. The freedom of expression is real freedom in a land based and formed by oppression.
What is your goal as a writer? What do you try to do as a writer?
I try to share depth perception and share truths about society that most people can see, but they won't talk about. A la Eldridge, but also a la Frantz Fanon. No one went deeper than Frantz Fanon. I mean, you got to remember, as a psychiatrist, it's very difficult to be deeper than Frantz Fanon. You know, but he was also, I mean, there's a book it's probably very little known, because most people think about Wretched of the Earth, but Towards the African Revolution.
Yeah, that's a gem.
Ooh, I mean, this cat, you know, you learn kind of reading that he was the chief correspondent for the FLN's organ, El Mujahid. And he wrote some hot, hot shit right there in the heat of the revolution. And there are chapters in the end of that book which shows military planning, targets of the empire and the colonialists, and targets in other countries. I'm like, damn, Frantz Fanon was the truth.
Yeah.
He was the truth.
Hold on, I want to pivot just a little bit because you're such a humble dude, but there's a whole generation of writers and readers who see you that way. Did you expect that? How do you make sense of that? That there are people, when they talk about these great writers, these great intellectuals, these great sort of inspirational figures as not just as political prisoners, but as political writers and theorists, they throw your name right in the mix, man. How do you make sense of that?
Well, I make sense of it because it's not a false humility. It's that I've read some very good shit, you know, and I've studied some very good shit. And, you know, one of the ways I've studied that is being an observer in America's core, in their prisons, and seeing the nakedness of oppression.
Yeah.
And seeing how people are treated because they're powerless in the midst of a repressive capitalist state. So, you know, Fanon, I think I was probably 15 when I first read it. And I had to, you know, read it years later to really understand a lot of stuff. Because, you know, when you're reading in the organization, you're reading under the pressure of, I got to discuss this tomorrow at a PE or a political education meeting. So you're pushing instead of reading. And to go back and read Fanon, and then to read Huey, to read George Jackson, to read Eldridge Cleaver, these are thinkers who were active in the Black Revolution, the Black freedom struggle, and writing to expand what that meant. So I see myself as part of those kinds of traditions.
Do you feel a need to only write political stuff? I mean, there's a way that given your status, given your case, given being a political prisoner, given your context, there's a level of guardedness you have to have because you're being attacked at all sides. Are there other reasons why you don't feel vulnerable as a writer? Like, do you ever feel like you can write about yourself, to write a memoir, to write a play, to write about your emotions? Do you feel space to do that, or is the political pressure too intense?
Well, there is political pressure because, you know, there's a clock running. And this was very clear when you're on death row. And, you know, I probably wrote some of my best shit when I had a death warrant on me.
Wow.
So, because it's real, correct?
Yes.
So you're pressured now to communicate those thoughts that are moving through your blood and your consciousness. But, you know, there have been times when I've been, like, poetic and, in some respects, autobiographical. Death Blossoms comes to mind.
Yes.
You know.
That was probably your most reflective. I think what you and I did had some, you know, when we wrote Classroom in the Cell, there were some pieces in the love chapter, the masculinity chapter, et cetera. But Death Blossoms is probably the work you've done that is the most kind of personal and the most kind of reflective of who you are, not just as a political figure, but as a thinker and as a feeler in the world.
I would not disagree. Although now that I think about it, I think the closest I've come to personal is in our discussion, you know, thanks to James Baldwin.
Yeah.
Who kind of influenced us.
Yeah, right? Baldwin and Margaret Mead, yeah.
And Margaret Mead, they gave us permission. And I think we went places that will really surprise some people. Shit, it surprised me. And I'm sure it did you.
Oh, it surprised the hell out of me.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and I think that, you know, in this impersonal world, we need that to reach persons. And not from a political perspective, but from a human perspective.
Mm.
A human contextual perspective.
You think you'll ever write anything even more personal, like a memoir or a book of poems or, you know, personal poems, not political poems? I know how talented you are, I know how creative you are. People don't even know how funny you are. So I wonder sometimes if, like, there's other parts of you that you ever want to show on the page.
I don't see the need now.
Okay.
But there may come a time when it's, you know, it makes perfect sense. But, you know, I'm still behind the wall. You know, I'm still under the gun. And that prohibits a lot of stuff. So
that makes a lot of sense. We talk a lot about writing, but one of the things that happens in prison that's so important is the process or the practice of letter writing. How important has the practice of reading and writing letters been for you while you've been incarcerated?
It's been vital, and that's because communications is vital as regards reading. I mean, like, a lot of cats will come up and ask me how to publish, how to do this, how to do that. And I give them the truest truth I can give them. And I say, listen, if you want to write, first you got to read. And then you got to ask yourself, what is it about what you read that turns you on? And that'll show you, like, tricks of the trade, shit like that.
Yeah.
Most dudes think I'm, like, blowing them off because that sounds like too much work. But that's the truth. That's the truth. I mean, every book that you read leaves a mark on you, on consciousness. But more importantly, there are lessons to be learned in why the books you read, like, freak you and turn you on. You know, for years I didn't read fiction or novels. But when I was up Huntington, because that's the only thing that was in the library, that's all I read. You know, there were some cats that I had to read if there was a book by them in there.
Hmm.
You know, and mostly this was, I would get sci-fi until they began sending me the same books over and over and over, like Asimov.
This is a call from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
And, you know, what you learn by reading books that you like or that move you or excite you or just keep you turning the page is how to create a page turner. I mean, there's techniques to that.
Hmm.
And there's no kind of short and fast rule to do that. But if you read people that you enjoy, even for fun, you'll learn 1,000 tricks that they have.
Yeah.
You know?
I want to come back to this letter writing thing for a second, because part of what I was thinking about, you know, people don't necessarily write letters like they used to. You know, we send texts, we send emails. You know, you go back and you'll read, like, you know, the letters between Hansberry and Baldwin or whoever. But, you know, letter writing is a kind of intimacy and a kind of emotional thing and a kind of personal thing. But when it comes to incarcerated folk, we still write letters to family in prison. We still write letters to people. But that's changing too, no?
That is changing. And, you know, I mean, you know, they have tablets. So, you know, most guys will get the equivalent of an email, and letters have become exceedingly light, especially in light of the faux drama that they started about 2 years ago, saying that they were getting drugs through the mail. Now, when someone writes you, they have to write to Florida. They Xerox it, send a digital copy up here, and they, you know, Xerox the copy and send you the copy. So one of the things, when you get a letter like a
child or a card from your wife, you know, everything about that is special. The texture, the smells, the smudges, everything. Xerox doesn't capture that, unfortunately. Mm. So it's become a colder, colder enterprise.
Wow.
They've, like, violated this last space, letter writing. The wow. letters, they come open, Xerox, stapled. Come on, man.
Yeah, and
you know, it's bullshit.
People aren't going to feel as comfortable. I mean, we always knew they were reading our letters, right? But there's something about getting in this form that does make it different. As someone who's been incarcerated for so long, what have letters done for you personally? Like the letters you receive and the letters you get to send out to people you care about or people you don't even know. How does that help?
Of course, it depends on, you know, what's being said, but I respond to quite a few. I can't respond to them all because I still get a fair degree. And I try to keep it personal and even intimate in some respects, you know, because I know that, as you suggested, you know, writing is becoming a lost art. That is handwriting, writing by hand. And for a whole generation of people, we forget that for people under, say, 20, 25, cursive is a lost art. They don't know how to do that anymore. I remember the little sister that was on the stand for the brother that was, you know, killed down in Florida.
Rachel Jontel, the friend of Trayvon Martin, who was killed by George Zimmerman.
Yeah. People laughed at her because she didn't understand how to write cursive, but she was a bright young sister. But I know that of people of her generation, they're not taught cursive.
Right. At all.
At all. So they're more computer literate, and if you wrote something in cursive to them, they could not interpret that because they don't know what that is. So, you know, something is passing literally like before our eyes.
Yeah.
And it's a form of personal communication with a very simple technology, you know, a pen or a pencil on a piece of paper.
Yeah. Letters aren't the only thing that have been cut out of everyday prison life. Books themselves have been extremely limited. There was a time where we could mail books to the prisons, where bookstores prided themselves in shipping to prisons. Now, we can't just mail books directly to prison. There are restrictions on that, too.
Well, you know, they've always had a war against books. I mean, people don't know. If you read my Jailhouse Lawyer's book, you'll read about Richard Mayberry. He filed suits in the 60s about getting law books because he studied law very intensely. This is a jailhouse lawyer that's like a legendary jailhouse lawyer. Well, when they found law books in his cell, they threw him in the hole. Just straight, you know. And he rumbled for that and won. But there was a time that a prison might have a raggedy library, you know, of locally donated books or something. But books have always been looked at with hostility because knowledge is looked at with hostility. This is an oppressed class who comes in oppressed and for the most part leaves just as oppressed. And in most cases, just as ignorant as one has arrived.
Yeah.
They really detest people learning prison, which shows you the draconian and repressive nature of the state itself.
Yeah. You know, working with some of the volunteer programs like Books Through Bars, where we've tried to get books into the prisons, we've been somewhat successful getting some paperbacks in and some other things. But in the last 5 years, it's gotten much more difficult where now they tell us, oh, you can't just send the book. There's an approved book list and we have to order from somebody else's company. And so it's another space that seems to have been co-opted and profitized. And it's so much harder to get free speech in.
But it's also another form of obstruction. Like books are supposedly in this country of free speech, as free as the imagination. You know, they still wage war against George Jackson's book.
Yeah.
Try to send somebody George Jackson's book. It's coming back. In some states, you try to send them my book. It's coming back, you know, because they represent a mindset that sees black liberation as threatening. Black freedom as threatening this state. And that has not changed, brother. And it hasn't changed whether you have a black commissioner or a black secretary
or black guards, or it doesn't matter. It don't even matter.
What are some of the biggest books that people inside you find read? Like, what are some of the things that you see people reading the most consistently?
Hood novels. Hood novels are very, very popular and lucrative, you know, to the publishers and perhaps by extension, the writers. I think they're incredibly simplistic. You know, that one may read them, but you're not going to learn a great deal from them.
Talk to me about what you want to write moving forward, man. I mean, you've written all kinds of stuff. What's next for you?
You know what the greatest challenge would be for me? Because I've never really tried it, but I've always, you know, like, loved the form and wanted to do it. But, you know, it's the greatest challenge, just like novels.
Oh.
Right. But, you know, I've thought of it for years, but I've never really kind of dove in because other, you know, things have hit me and other things were necessary at the time. But my highest regard is for novelists because, you know, someone like Toni Morrison or even, you know, W.B. Du Bois did a few leaps in that direction.
Yeah.
Science fiction. So it's the highest art because you create worlds. You're a world creator. And when I was up Huntington, I mean, I kind of bled their science fiction.
This is a call from
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
So I would read like Asimov and all kinds of people. It's just the highest art, man. Those cats, if you're good at it, you're a real artist. And, you know, think about, you know, what I never really talk about this because I know it would freak people. One of the greatest American writers alive today is Stephen King. Stephen motherfucking King.
Stephen King.
You know, I don't want to blow his shit up, but, I mean, he's a bad motherfucker. I would read his novels, go to sleep, and for the next 2 or 3 hours, because I couldn't go to sleep before 3 or 4 in the morning because I couldn't put it down. And I began studying his stuff to learn, like, you know, literary tricks. And I would go to sleep, and 2 or 3 chapters would pop up in my head because I'm still dreaming about the book. This is a bad motherfucker. This guy is like beyond, and he don't get his props because, you know, he comes from New England, I think New Hampshire, but a white working class background. And think about some of his greatest work. I mean, I love the movie and I really love the book. Remember The Stand?
Yeah.
Yeah, Ruby D, man. Ruby D playing.
This is a call from
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Like the voice of God, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so he's really quite remarkable, man. He's a remarkable cat. Hell of a writer.
No, he's definitely a hell of a writer. You talked about reading Stephen King and sort of having the characters stay with you, you know, at night and the next day and so forth. What role does fiction play for not just you, but maybe for other sort of people who are incarcerated? I mean, it would seem to me that fiction would be a powerful outlet to escape your immediate surroundings, to imagine new worlds. I mean, has fiction done that for you or anybody you know?
Well, I think it has, especially for radical people, sci-fi does, because you really, you know, to a radical revolutionary, you need to reimagine new worlds, right? But fortunately, you know, if you go through the boxes under the beds of most cats in these joints, they got hood novels. And, you know, the sad truth of that is they're like mimeograph and the few names has changed. It's the same shit. You know, it's no plot, no character. It's hustling. It's another form of hustling. Instead of selling crack, you're selling novels, hood novels, you know, gangster shit. But for a lot of people who are radicals, science fiction gives you a way of imagining new worlds that are possible.
And those new worlds, I guess, I mean, there's the idea of escape and sort of imagine those worlds just for your own well-being. But then there's also what that could mean maybe for, as you said, revolutionaries and radicals who are trying to actually make new worlds, right? I mean, like, it can give you some ideas.
Absolutely, because if you can't imagine it, brother, it cannot come into being. I think, you know, during the Wall Street protests, you know, one of the things that came from that movement was not just about the 1%, but another world is possible.
Right.
I heard young people saying that. And, you know, some novels, you know, give us precisely that, you know, imagining another world different from this world. You know, like Terry Bisson, right, who, sci-fi writer. Kentucky, actually. He wrote a book called Fire on the Mountain. And he imagined what would happen if John Brown went down to the armory and the slaves rebelled, and he won. You know what I mean? And you know, it would be two different states. It was United States of America and what he called Nova Africana, New Africa. Think about that.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, reading that, I mean, I wept because so many ideas were in that. It made me see another world as possible, you know? And John Brown was that boy. I think he's probably the most loved white person among black people because he went all the way.
Right. You talked about what some of the other brothers who are inside are reading. Do you find yourself recommending books to folk? Are you like the guy people go to for advice on what to read? Are you like the go-to, like almost like not librarian, but like the book guy?
Well, I stopped doing that. You know why?
Why?
Because I'd be like, read this. And next thing you know, brother man that got transferred. And I'm, you know, my shit's gone.
You was actually loaning the books, right?
No more. Mm-mm. Too many disappeared. And, you know, you got young brothers doing triple life and quarter life and all that. You know, you ain't going to see them no more. It's been 40 years, you know. So I stopped that. Now, I give advice. Cats ask me about, you know, well, I want to write a book, so and so. You know what I tell them?
What?
They think I'm blowing them off, but I'm giving them my deepest knowledge from what I've learned. That the best thing you can do if you want to write books is to read books and then study what it is that pushes your button, what turns you on, what amazes you, what thrills you, what can't you put down, and then read it and read it and read it and find out why. Only you can answer those questions, but those questions are in there for a reason. And once you learn those techniques, it gives you gifts that you can use in your writing. I learned immeasurable things from Stephen King, just reading Stephen King. You know, these are 1,000, 1,400-page novels, bro. First of all, you know, that's like 2 days.
Right.
2 days. So your week is burned out, and you're living in another world. You're on death row, but you're on another planet or in another reality, in another state. And think about this. I'm wondering why nobody talks about The Stand right now in the age of pandemic. When that's the core of his book, The Stand. We're living in this shit. And it ain't science fiction, bro. I wish it were. This is real shit.
Yo, it did.
400,000 people? Come on, man.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely crazy. Let me ask you a question. If you were not inside, if you were home, what kind of writer would you be?
I don't even know if I would be a writer. I would, you know, I certainly would have exhausted the world of journalism to my highest exertion. But, you know, when I dream, I don't limit my dreams. And, like, one of the things that I learned this playing handball up in Huntington for so many years, I want to be a tennis player.
Oh, wow.
Because I learned by watching them that they are superb athletes. And I didn't think that when I was a young man. You know, of course, you looked at football players, boxers, and all that. But, listen, tennis? Come on, man. I've seen dudes go for 7-8 hours. Like, damn!
Yeah.
You know, just lobbing it. So, it's the closest thing to boxing.
Wow.
It's one-on-one. And it's intense, and it demands everything from you.
So, in some ways, writing is, and not that you wouldn't write at all, but it sounds like you're saying, in some ways, writing has become a necessity given your circumstance.
Right. Writing is, to quote Ishmael Reed, writing is fighting. So it's become my weapon of choice.
Wow. That's a hell of a way to think about it. So that means then you're going to be writing for as long as you're breathing.
I'm a damn sure try. How about that? You know, you're always thinking. You're always growing, hopefully.
Yeah.
You know, life is growth.
Life definitely is growth, man. And watching your growth has been extraordinary. I know you have other intellectual endeavors you've been taking up lately. Can you talk about them?
Well, I'm always curious. So, you know, maybe about 2 or 3 months ago, I bought a chemistry book. And I was, like, fascinated at what I did not know. I was, like, stunned by it. I'm like, wait a minute. Plasma is a state? What the hell? How did that happen?
Why chemistry? You just decided chemistry was going to be the move?
I was just curious because, you know, I went to a public school and, you know, they skimped over that. Even though, you know, they had great teachers, I was a poor student. You know, I went to school to look at the pretty girls.
not the chemistry books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, but, you know, to learn things that are fundamental in chemistry is mind expanding. You know, I didn't know what plasma, I thought plasma was some kind of liquid or something. I didn't know it's the stuff inside stars. It's the stuff inside of lightning. Come on, man. That's like, wow.
Shit, you just taught me something.
Hey, man. Hey, I'm reading the book. It's a challenge.
If you were left on an island and you could only have three books, you know what? You caged, man. They got you caged in a dungeon, man. If you could only have three books with you, even in prison where you are, and you had to only sit with three books for the rest of your time, what would those three books be?
I don't know. I've always loved and hated those questions because I love it because, you know, these are the kind of questions that Malcolm, Martin, and Eldridge were asked by Playboy. Right? When they were interviewed.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a difficult thing, especially if you love books, because three is torture.
Right.
You know, 300 is comfort. It's food. But one of them would have to be The Wretched of the Earth by Frantz Fanon of Martinique.
Mm.
Because this brother, man, I mean, he continues all these years later.
This is a call from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Such profound insights, you know, into the freedom and the anti-colonial struggle and neocolonialism. I mean, you know, when you read him and actually listen to him, he was predicting. He was using his analytical skills as a psychoanalyst, psychologist, and psychiatrist to see where the world was and where it would go if people did not take the anti-colonial threat seriously and struggle with all their might. You look at Africa, man, it's almost like Fanon drew this map and said, this is what this will be if you allow it to be.
Mm.
And that's an extraordinary skill. So one would have to be The Wretched of the Earth. I mean, we could debate for months about the other two and have knuckle down fights and all that, but...
Well, I gotta press you because I make all the other guys... I'm being a little nice with you because you've been through a lot. But you're gonna have to... I'm gonna make you pick two more.
Well, you know, the truth is, I was about to be real, real slick and say something like, oh, shit, I've been on that island. I've been on that island most of my life.
Exactly. That's why I said, look, I ain't gonna play the island game. I'm just gonna be like, you got three books. You already there, you know.
You know what, though? It's like... You know, I've been through shit sometimes, and you look at a book, man, you sense its beauty and its worth. I remember, man, I dropped tears about Beloved.
Oof.
By Toni Morrison, because it was she's such a wonderful writer, man.
Yeah.
And she's such an artist who crafts it with such insight and precision, but loving beauty and loving ugliness.
Mm.
You know, when we talk about, like, abolition, a lot of scholars and thinkers and activists, that's like a bird without wings. Because, you know, it ain't flying. Right? Yeah. Not right now. Not in this. But you know what is a bird with wings?
What?
A book, brother.
Mm.
Because I've seen with my own eyes how they awaken brothers and sisters, especially in here, and especially brothers who learn to read in here. How they open up their souls and open up interior spaces and make them anew, you know, deepen and enrich their perceptions and comprehension. And so we have to be careful about birds, brother.
I know that. I know that's right, brother. Well, I hope you know that your work, your books have helped a whole lot of people fly out of their conditions, whether it's those dungeons that you're caged in, or whether it's the prison of white supremacy, whether it's the prisons of our self-hate, whether it's the prisons of just unawareness of just how complicated and messy this world is. Your books, your writing, your ideas, your intellectual work, your courage, your bravery has liberated a whole bunch of people, man. And I'm so glad you took some time to talk to me about who you are as a writer and as a reader.
Brother, it's been my pleasure to share this time with you, because
you know, we both are walking, you know, on similar paths. Mine just has more bars. But yours may have more bars, but you can't see them because you have the illusion of freedom. You dig?
Woo!
Come on now.
I dig.
Hold on here. Come on.
You're going to have me running around this room like I'm in church.
All right, brother.
I love you, man.
You well?
Oh, man.
Brother, it's always a pleasure.
You not always.
Keep it up. Keep your spirit shining.
Yes, sir.
Number love.
Peace. On the move.
On the move.
Coffee and Books is a production of Embassy Row. Our executive producer is Sarnie Rogers. This episode was produced by Karis Nelson. The show was edited by Maureen Bigas. And you can follow me on Instagram at Mark Lamont Hill and the show on Instagram at Coffee and Books Show. Catch you next week.